All lines are now bridged.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the HITECH's annual report work group virtual meeting. We have our small but mighty team, our two co-chairs, Carolyn Peterson and Aaron Murray, also joined by Christina Carballo and Brett Oliver. With that, I want to thank you for your time, and we'll turn it over to our co-chairs to get us started on next steps for the report.
All right. It's great to see everyone this afternoon. It feels like we're making a lot of progress really fast, and I'm excited that we're able to get in another meeting this month and really keep things moving. Welcome.
Yeah, welcome everybody. I'm glad to see everybody on, and some new folks too I see that have joined us and are part of the participants today. So thank you for joining us. For those of the public listening in, we have been making some great progress. I think the last HITECH meeting was very illuminating. We got some great feedback, which we can talk about today as we go through the various topics. And I think our discussion also on electronic case reporting is the way it started on public health domain, but then it expanded to a number of public health components specific around COVID, but also, you know, in general, also I think were very, very illuminating. And you also see reflected in this report. And so, you know, I think I'll echo what Carolyn said, which is I feel very confident we are on the right track with topics. I think we're also on the right track in terms of things we should be considering or ask for consideration to think about next year. And I also think that this group has done a great job of pulling out of the industry you know, relevant, salient topics that we should be thinking about, whether it's artificial intelligence, whether it's things like that, that will be on the near-term horizon in no time at all. So with that, I think we should get into it. Carolyn, if you want to kick us off, and I'll pick it up at the crosswalk.
Sure. Okay. So here's our usual approach. Today we're looking at crosswalk of topics, and we'll see how far through this we get. We might finish early or we might not, kind of depending on where we're at. We will have our public comment period and then adjourn until our next meeting. Pretty soon. So, okay. So here we are. We're working on the crosswalk of topics today, and potentially that will continue at the next meeting at the end of September. If not, well, you know, we'll just keep pushing. We've got a meeting in October, in November, in December, and then after that, we're looking to bring the draft to the full HITECH for review and approval. And here we are on our schedule. This is the HITECH schedule, the big meeting on the 21st, the 10th, and then next year. So today, we're looking at the draft crosswalk of topics. And then we'll be presenting an update on that crosswalk in October at the full HITECH meeting. And the October meeting is like a week later than usual, so that should give us plenty of runway to get this in good shape and feel like we have a good, solid base for discussion. Slide, please. Okay. I think Aaron was going to grab it from here.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go into it. All right, so next slide. All right, so we're going to go into the crosswalk now and talk about these four priority target areas. For those of you who listened to the big HITECH call the other week, we also spoke a bit about this, but we're going to go into details now. So again, the first target area are technologies to support public health, like I mentioned earlier. Second target area is interoperability. Third is privacy and security, and fourth is patient access to information. You'll recognize these topics also for those that are new to joining us and listening in, that a lot of these were directly from 21st Century Cures and what we were charged with looking at as terms of the HITECH. So we want to make sure we stay as close to charter as possible on these kind of things. Next slide. All right, oh, that's the public comment. Let's go into the actual crosswalk now. Can you pull it up, please, for me? All right, perfect. Maybe blow that up. All right. Okie doke. And so, Michelle, can you keep me honest? Which one did we leave off of last time? Because I want to rehash the past, unless there's a topic. Which one did we leave off of? We start here at the top?
You ended in interoperability with the new topic idea about health equity. So the next one would be sharing data with the research community.
That's perfect. That's where we were. Okay. All right. And so to this topic, so the way we, to those who are new listening in or anybody listening in, the way we do this is, again, we went by each of the category areas and then each of the items within. And so we're going to pick up where we left off last time, because you can imagine the topics on this. So we're starting again here with the sharing data with the research community. The gap that this group identified was the challenge by data quality and consistency concerns, limited governance structures and policies allowing access to data, inconsistent implementations across technical architecture, and varying needs of individuals and organizations that create and use data. So my challenge here is like human subjects in a common rule, consent and privacy. I think there's consent items here. We have found a number of issues with sharing data, particularly with other restrictions that are in place in academic healthcare systems. We've been warned by federal agencies of foreign actors attempting to get data, particularly recently it's been on COVID-19 data. So there's been a lot of how do we share data appropriately in addition to data quality, data provenance, consistency, all these other items. And so what we want to talk about as a group with us is what do we think we should present back to the HITECH as what we need to do around this. I'll give you a real-world example. I think you all know me by now. I like to talk about stories. Here at UT, we have a number of initiatives and research that we are partaking in. One of those is trying to get in front of dementia and delirium and getting in front of patients that are delirious or potentially have the onset of delirium, which is one of the most cognitive destructive states out there. To get that data requires this is a research project, a giant funded research project. It takes data from EMS, takes data from us, takes data from other hospital systems in the region, as well as long-term rehab, nursing homes, all sorts of things. It has been very difficult, and the data that we do get imported into us, even with the right data agreements and whatnot, has data variability in it. You have to really massage it to get it to know what you're looking at. As they always say, data is not insight, right? But the problem is that there's no true standard of how to share data on a research level. Maybe that's something the TESCA could help out with one day, but even then it becomes difficult, becomes murky, and you got to make sure you have consent or an IRB waiver or something to that effect. So I say that with this is a very broad topic when it comes to research, but it is very salient, particularly with COVID-19 and other issues going on. And there may be a way, whether it's leveraging US CDI standards, whether it's proposing standards, whether it's proposing more in-depth research task forces, that we could tear this item apart and really solve it thoroughly. What do you all think? Maybe Brett, we'll start with you since you're the physician. Go ahead, sir.
Is the gap data beyond US CDI? Or is it more the quality?
It tends to be both, actually. From my perspective, it's both, right? So you've got data, obviously, there's some of it's structured, especially from the note or from the medical record. Some of it's unstructured because you've got ambulance transfer forms, right? The pink slips, right? Those are literally pieces of paper that are scanned into some PDF. You've got I'm using my delirium example here, right? And then you've got all these other data sources that are from EMRs that were not, unfortunately, given investment dollars in about a decade ago for the ARRA, right? So you've got systems that do not fall under the auspice of having respective standards they got to follow. So it's a little bit of everything, which is impacting then at the end of the day the result. And then if, say, Brett, you're doing a QI project or even an IRB-approved research project, you're frustrated because you're like, what am I looking at, right?
Right. I almost feel like it ought to be on the timeline, but later – yeah, in the sense that we don't know what opportunities are going to open up with just simply the information blocking rule in USCDI going into effect in November. There are several things just from like my perspective that we're holding off on. For instance, we have, our EHR has a Community Connect sort of piece, and we get a lot of interest from other practices saying, hey, we want to connect to your instance. I'm encouraging them and our organization just to hold off a second, because all these, EMRs that are going to be forced to exchange this data, maybe that's going to be enough for CINs and ACOs and things, at least wait and see type of thing. But I don't know. I don't live in the research community to be able to say there, something that has to happen now. I'm just wondering if the US CDI and information blocking is placed, is made live, everybody has to comply. Does that, what parts of this challenge, this gap, are covered, and which ones still are not?
That's a great point. Carolyn, Christina?
Yeah, one thing to think about, I think there's groups that aren't going to wait. So when we think about like things like initiatives around social determinants of health, we've got great work happening, as we've talked about extensively in the Gravity Project, and they've recognized that they need to expand the domains more quickly and get like an implementation guide out because industry is asking for it more and more. I'm currently working in the DC market on a project with social determinants of health, and they're trying to align with national standards, but those standards aren't moving quickly enough, but these projects are moving. They need to happen. More and more community-based organizations are really interested in getting clinical data and information and making informed decisions to help patients. So I think this is becoming an increasingly important and hot topic. And when we think of health equity, I think it's really, really important to start thinking about how we're enabling data to reach and ecosystems to reach populations that are more vulnerable and kind of are suffering because of just lack of interoperability.
Mm. Good points. Carolyn?
Yeah, I agree about groups and people moving on things they think are important, particularly the SDOH and disparities. I think that can be happening with health equity also. I mean, it's certainly something that's trending all across society right now, not just health and health IT. I don't know how this exactly fits in, but I'm anticipating that there will be greater pressure on patients because people are in more extreme financial situations right now with even greater challenges in terms of paying for care, you know, because of reduced employment and all the COVID stuff that makes life more challenging and forces us to do things that add costs. So it's important, but it's also complex, this area.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So let me try to tease out a couple of bullets I just heard from you all as I was taking notes here. So one is obviously this is a major stumbling block that has multiple arms, right? I think of like an octopus, right? So there's numerous arms numerous tentacles we're going to go after here and go deal with. So is it worthwhile, because I know the HITACH has talked about this a lot, right? And particularly you have folks like Les and others that have brought this up numerous times that we need to deal with research, and I agree with that. Is this something we should call and ask for experts to come testify in front of the HITACH and illuminate some of these items, knowing that work is ongoing with information blocking and TEFCA, but at least we tease out all of the different dimensions that are true bugaboos today? Like I just spoke about in my one example. I'm posing as a question. What do you all think?
Yeah, I'm fine with that approach, Aaron. I don't know how it's going to be fruitful for people to go ahead, to move ahead. We have a USCDI process in place. So is that not what we should be funneling these lack of consistency and data quality concerns through? Or maybe I'm just missing the point of that. If groups are moving on, that's their prerogative, but that doesn't mean that we change our priorities that have already been outlined by ONC. I'm confused with what you were saying, Christina.
Yeah, Brett, and I hear you with like the telling your community data connect group to kind of hold for a second. I think what we should potentially do is like take a step back and listen to both sides. The groups that like the provider organizations that might be saying, okay, we've got a lot going on right now, this is what we're doing, and this is what we can support, and those that are kind of trying to push forward and build scalable solutions around things such as social determinants of health, that are trying to use standards so that they are able to scale. And I think what we might find is that, like, we've think through this a little bit, but I think an evaluation of where we kind of find a happy medium and advise on how to implement with standards and understand where the big gaps in standards exist would be helpful. I also think, like, when we are talking about more advanced standards that the hospitals might have, some of these smaller community-based groups may not be able to support them. So there's also a growing, like, another thing that we should look at is kind of the haves and have-nots of technology capabilities that are still trying to implement solutions that can interoperate amongst themselves.
Okay, so I think what I'm hearing is that we're recommending as a group for this item, so we can move on to the next item, is that we want to know some more specificity about the different dimensions of impact, whether it's data, quality, and provenance, whether it's process issues with how to advance a new class, whether it's does USCDI match and align to what the research community needs, et cetera, et cetera. And I do know that a lot of work has been done in this dimension as well, so we shouldn't try to recreate the wheel. And if I recall, top of memory only, that the ONC 5-year plan, I believe, also referenced research in there. So we should probably align to some of that work that's already been done, too, of what's already ongoing in the community. Does that sound like a plan?
Yes, and I do agree with Brett that going through the USCDI process is the right approach.
Maybe I could understand a little bit better. So are you saying maybe, okay, there's the USCDI process, and then but perhaps ONC could come up with the data standards, even if it's not required, but here's the standards to use for this data set so that there's some consistency there without it being part of the USCDI at that point?
Maybe I'm mute.
Christina,
you're on mute?
No, I'm thinking. You guys might have moved on to the research community too, and I was also incorporating the health equity, which we might have moved past. So I might have been a little off topic and calling myself out on that.
Okay.
I just want to totally understand. I get what you're saying is before we make it a requirement, could we throw out standards? That makes a lot of sense.
Like a voluntary framework?
Yeah, here's the framework we would recommend. It may become part of the USCDI in the future, but, you know, to expedite some of these.
That's a fair idea. And I think, I don't know, Carolyn, is that something we would propose as an idea to the HITAC? Because, I mean, we did it with the pediatric standards.
Lauren may not even know. It's only September. Do we have anything coming up, Lauren, in terms of work for the HITAC next year that we already know about where this would fit in? I mean, I'm thinking the pediatric stuff was a neat fit with the work that we were doing at that point in time. So it wasn't that we specifically wanted to go after the pediatric. It was that it was part of the NPRM.
So we're currently working on the work plan for the committee next year, so we don't have anything to share at this time, but we'll have an opportunity for the members to kind of weigh in on the broader plan of activities for the committee next year coming up soon.
Okay.
Let's put this on the list then as something that emerged from this working group and submitted as an idea on behalf of this group, because I do think it's relevant and I think it will probably be of interest, significant interest to at least some of the people on the full HITAC.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so in keeping with time then, I'm going to move us on, if everybody's okay with that, to the next one here, which is the establishment of common metadata and nomenclature in use. This is determining the types of metadata and related standards necessary to facilitate machine-based clinical data management, including management of exchange data to reconcile data from multiple sources. I'm going to go on the ledge. I'm not the one who came up with this one, but I'm pretty sure this tied right into the research community discussion. Does my memory serve me correct? Carolyn, do you remember this? This was part of it. I think this was part of that discussion.
I think you're right, Aaron.
It was a broad and all-encompassing discussion, as this topic usually is.
Yeah. Okay, so from Michelle and for everybody, I think we'll combine these two together in terms of data with the research community because I think this was a subtopic of that one. And we'll use the same promotion of, hey, let's find out some more about this from the full HITAC, and we can go into more details about it. All right, next item here. Correction of incorrect data and ramifications of exchange of incorrect data, right? So there's a limited ability to correct data that's already been exchanged. As a result, this incorrect data might persist and be further disseminated. Transparency about accuracy is shared, lacking for patients when it affects patient safety. This was Clem that said this, right? I think I remember this comment. And I agree with him, right? So the problem is, without the standards in place that have been adopted, without those kinds of things, both on research and clinical operations, and as US CDI is now in effect and being followed, this is an issue. But I think, again, this kind of goes back up with, you know, the research item. A lot of this, we have to fix it upstream for the downstream effect to look right. I mean, call me crazy here, but that's how I see it. Carolyn, Brett, Christina, what do you guys think?
Makes sense to me.
I think it's where you have to start, Aaron. And then, you know, somebody's going to have to define what my responsibility is as a provider and as a system, and I guess anybody that's producing the data. What is my responsibility if I find out what I got from you, Aaron, somebody moves up from Austin, and you tell me, hey, that CBC machine was off, we've corrected the values. Oh, well, they've already moved on to somebody. You know, what? That piece is, the liability piece is pretty nebulous. We just got done working with Epic on a data accuracy in the interoperable world sort of workflow for other Epic customers. So it's out there. It's a topic that I don't think anybody's got all the answers for.
Yeah. Okay. Christina?
Yeah, I'm in alignment with everyone else on this one.
Okay. So then what I'm hearing then, Michelle, for this one is that we will bundle this also with the research one, but make it a little bit more broad in terms of, if we fix the upstream stuff, this should get better, right? So I don't want to ever take any HITAC comments and put them aside, but this one could be mitigated with upstream work that we're also talking about. So it kind of fits in line with that. Okay.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, ma'am.
The source was a patient advocate on the HITAC. So I think they're trying to get at a patient access concern. So I just want to make sure we're still keeping that in the discussion as well.
Thank you. Thank you for that. That's what I was – okay. So this is patient access related, which, I mean, I still stand by it, though, that the upstream work and the stuff we talked about last time, and for folks that weren't on the call, it was around health equity. And when I say health equity, I mean by an even playing field for all patients of all demographics, of all types, sizes, colors, whatever, where they have equal access to their data and thus health care. And the abilities to be delivered care to them. And that's health equity, right? And so there's a strong push, and I agree with it, that it should be a level playing field and even for everybody. And so access to the right data, the right place, the right time is absolutely part of that equation. So if that's the case, then I still stand behind that this should be bundled in and will be addressed upstream. What do the rest of you think?
Michelle, that was helpful because I remember that conversation now. It was more around, if I remember correctly, if the patient thought something was wrong, not it was, you know, objectively wrong lab, it was the wrong patient. Patient says, no, I don't have this problem. And that's obviously a very sticky and legal liability, you know, question, but that's where I think that came from. So transparency in terms of what's available to review is one thing, but whoever creates the data should be the one that has the ability to correct it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty slippery slope if patients don't agree. I don't have diabetes. I don't. So you better take that out of there. Really? Like who makes that call? Is that? Do you remember that, Michelle?
I remember the conversation. I'm not remembering the nuance that you're talking about, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Okay. No, I didn't mean necessarily the diabetic one, but just it was
right.
That patients couldn't change what was in there. And I'm not sure that's what you
I think that's
to
what
do.
They were getting at. You're right. They wanted to have more of a voice in what's in their record and be able to fix it. And it was also an exchange issue. They were worried about the data being wrong and being forwarded to other groups mm-hmm. and not able to correct it there either.
Oh, I remember this conversation. Yes, that's right. That's right. That just jogged my memory. Okay. So are we still standing by our recommendation then, team, that this is an upstream and this will be fixed downstream, or is this something specific we want to talk about?
Or do we want to move this to the other topic area? Patient access.
Where would you move it, Carolyn?
To the patient access.
Topic area. As I recall, there wasn't a whole lot there.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to move it to patient access.
And just thinking, since that was the context in which it came to us.
Yep. Okay, so we're going to move that to the other area, and then okay, I'm good with that then. Do we want to move on then to the next target area, or do we want to stay on that topic?
Is there more to say about it?
I don't think there is, but I just want to make sure that we didn't miss any of the dimensions. Michelle's doing a good job of keeping us honest. So,
so my question to you is, do you see specific challenges, opportunities, or recommendations you want to help fill in on the chart at this point, or do you want to come back to it and talk about it more later on?
I think we come back.
I think I would just say in the future, I'd like to have a better understanding of what are the legal statutes that already surround this.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're about information exchange, and nobody on this call or on the high tech really has a problem with that. We're talking about correcting the data, and maybe that's not even the right phrase, but having data that's in dispute, what happens there?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the law says currently.
Yeah, I don't know enough. That's right. I don't know. Okay, so we're going to come back to this. Is everybody okay with that? We're going to go find out more. All right, let's move on. Privacy and security, my favorite topics here. All right. Topic is protections for data generated outside of HIPAA framework, federal privacy laws and regulations beyond HIPAA. So the gap is lack of clear rules for data not subject to HIPAA protections. And the challenge, of course, for third-party access to health data, there are implications of private sector partnerships between apps and payers, e.g. What we saw play out in the news between Google and the Ascension healthcare system. And as we've seen, you know, publicized, although probably buried with all the other news going on with COVID, folks like 23andMe selling the data, your genomics data, other companies that sort of fall out of HIPAA jurisdiction, but that don't really fall into FTC jurisdiction, and it's kind of this gray area. I feel like there's been a lot of discussion about this in the past couple of months, again, interspersed with COVID. What do you all think? Because I think this is a huge gap, but there's a lot of work going on here. Carolyn, what do you think?
Yeah, I certainly agree it's important, and I think we all know about the gap. And there's no shortage of perspective pieces high visibility journals addressing the fact that we need to do something about data that's not covered under HIPAA. If we can have a sort of if HITACH could have a joint meeting with representatives from other organizations that get at some of these issues, like FTC, for example, or OCR, I would support a meeting similar to some of the hearings that we've had in the past on other topics. I would support launching some kind of shared interagency activities to try to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm totally behind it all the way. It seems that so far it's been a really intractable thing because we just don't have power to make things happen as a high tech.
Right. Brett, Christina, your thoughts?
I like the way Carolyn's outlined it.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, sorry. I got kicked off the call at the bottom of the last one. I just got back in. Where are we?
We're talking about HIPAA and data generated outside of HIPAA that doesn't qualify, right? Like genomics data, partnerships with third parties like Ascension and Google, that sort of thing. So So the comment, so the idea was, and Carolyn brought up a good point, which is we can call a hearing and have folks from the OCR or other agencies come talk to us and tell us what they're working on. I know there's work going on Capitol Hill, or there was, related to this issue, again, more before COVID. So this isn't something that's lost upon folks. People know there's issues here. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds great. I think I came in when I heard Carolyn say OCR and thumbs up. And I think that what you just said, a hearing around this sounds like a really great idea.
Brett?
Agree. Thanks.
Okay. All right. And then I think the next item here is the same as this first one here, which is protections for data generated outside the HIPAA framework. There's lack of clarity about parameters of data sharing and disclosure and implications. I mean, we need to learn more. There's so much going on here that I would hate for us to go recreate the wheel or go against what's already working, being worked on, and the committee could probably all learn about what's going on between the agencies, I would think. So I'm in favor of bundling these two items together.
Did we unbundle them previously because they were because the actors who would work on them or could work on them were different, and you might be looking at a separate set of activities even though they would hopefully keep each other in the loop? Or am I misthinking?
I don't recall, but I may not have been part of that conversation, Carolyn. I don't recall that, but that's logical.
Ms. Michelle, on this list, I think they were unbundled principally because the gaps are different, but I think they are different partly because of what Carolyn's saying, that there are different actors and therefore maybe different approaches. So if you don't want to keep them separate, we don't have to, but just they kind of were because there might be slightly different discussions.
But it'd be the same agencies, right, Carolyn and team? I mean, it'd be the same folks, right? You got OCR, FTC, potentially FDA. Right. I mean, these are the same people. It's just different activities.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think that there's certainly been more activity around, more interest behind some privacy legislation that might not come at it from the we're here to deal with the non-HIPAA stuff. It might just be like a general privacy thing intended to cover social media at large, consumer over-the-counter genetics kits, over-the-counter, God forbid, COVID tests, you know, and so forth. We think about it in terms of something that FTC manages, privacy as something that FTC manages because it has a security role and it can use that to leverage what people do that affects privacy. And we think about OCR because there are discrimination aspects. But that's just a pre-existing framework based upon historical situations. And we could really be looking at something completely different in the future, especially if there's a decision to go down the road with, say, COVID passports or some kind of scheme for reporting and verifying test results so that people can travel, or when you go to the hospital, you can have visitors with you, or you have to go alone because your visitors don't have the kind of proof that they should be not transmitting right now. Or other stuff.
Okay. No, I agree with you. So do we want to then recommend the same thing where we really need to know more and maybe we can ask for more research on this? Maybe, I don't know, Michelle, if there's time. Could this be something that AI kind of gives us a landscape, like, update on what's going on?
Yeah, I can look into that for you.
Because I just feel like I don't have enough eyeballs on all the different pieces moving on this, regardless of who the actors are.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay. So we're going to come back to this one then. And unless Brett or Christine, unless you guys feel differently, let's get some more data in front of us and then figure out how we're going to recommend this to the high tech. Because I think this is an important topic, but I don't want to go there like without like up-to-date knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Internet of Things. There's limited interoperability between IoT vendors. As IoT objects become more integrated with the health IT system, security risks increase. Additional concerns have been raised regarding the challenges of informed consent. Yep, that's for sure. For users of IoT technologies. Michelle, is there anything else on the next page on this one?
Not on that one. I'm going to make sure we do come back to the one before it.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Nope,
okay,
that's fine. Yep, all right. So, so for Internet of Things, is this something that is relevant today or not? I'll give you a specific example. Again, more stories for you, right? So, one of the programs we put in place to manage our COVID-19 population was home monitoring. This is temperature home monitoring. So we prescribed Bluetooth temperature thermometers that patients could take with them if they were suspected COVID or COVID positive test came back. That way they could check in via a remote app, Android, iOS, or web-based on a periodic basis, and then we could intervene if their temperature was going and past certain thresholds. And we built in some clinical decision support rules to automatically alert, like if your temperature shoots up to 103 or something, you know, within a short range, so we could immediately intervene and get to you before you have a major event occur to you. Obviously, it took a lot of consent. It took a lot of consenting for people to do that. It took a lot for us to work with the actual manufacturers of these technology stacks. We had a really good third party we were partnering with that kind of helped us navigate that, but it wasn't clear. And it really wasn't clear to make sure that that data was only ours and that once the patient consented in, that it was being used for, in this case, COVID-19 treatment purposes, and that it wouldn't be used for other reasons. I mean, there's a lot of items here around consent and IoT that just were murky. And we may err on the side of caution and ask too many times for consent, but you know what? I'd rather ask 10 times than not. So we try to cover all of our bases, but it's not clear. So if you look at these things, and then getting that data back, right? How is the data structured? How would it be imported into the chart eventually? That sort of thing was a lot to work through. So a lot of that mapping had to be done, a lot of manual work. So that's just a real-world example of how IoT devices play in your ecosystem and some of the behind-the-scenes challenges to integrate them. Not that it's a bad thing, it's the right thing to do, but each manufacturer tends to have their own playbook. And it comes back down to standards, and it comes back down to other concerns, security concerns, what data is stored on the devices. In my case, thermometers don't store really anything locally, it just transmits. Or it's like stored in like random access memory, nothing like long-term, so it's really short-term memory. So to the degree of it, we were able to overcome any compliance concerns or security concerns, but still it's a risk. So how, knowing that this is the problem with IoT devices, but yet they are absolutely presenting themselves, and even with a new Apple Watch yesterday now announced that can do O2 monitoring, how do we feel we should tackle this? Because this is another big, deep, and wide topic. What do you all think?
Aaron, as you were talking through that example, it seems to tie into the topic above with the HIPAA framework. I'm specifically thinking of like third-party apps and getting patient-generated health data, both getting it to the app and app sending it back.
Mm-hmm.
I see where they could be separate, but I could, if this was emerging, but that's an identified kind of hot topic within this, we could potentially put it up in a bundle with the others, with the HIPAA framework ones.
That's a great thought. What do you all think? What do everybody else think?
Yeah, I could do that.
Okay. Brett, what do you think, sir?
I think that makes sense. Yeah, I think it makes sense.
I'm curious, Brett, from a practitioner's perspective, as a provider seeing patients every day, when it comes to IoT devices, you've said the high tech numerous times that some of that data is worthwhile to you as a physician. Some of it is just great background, like sort of reference material. When we say IoT devices, is there any qualification in your mind as a physician that certain types of devices, I'm going to give an example, a pulse ox device or something that does true EKG and has been validated, this has more, I'm going to use the word weight or merit in your mind from a clinical sense than, say, a thermometer, right? So are there classes of IoT devices, what I'm getting at, that we should be paying attention to if we do elevate this as part of a HIPAA or whatever else so that we're not trying to boil the ocean?
Oh, boy, Aaron, that's a great question. There's certainly that data that we request, and maybe it's an IoT device or it's something that we've already integrated. So there's that piece versus, you know, someone's heart rate from their Fitbit or something that clinically we didn't ask for, but the patient wants to share with us. I'd have to think about that a little bit more. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm at, yeah, and I totally appreciate that, because this is a big topic, and my only worry is if we elevate the totality of Internet things into the HIPAA discussion, we'll get lost in the weeds because it's just so wide. But if we focus it on classes of devices, right, maybe it's FDA-approved IoT devices, which I'm seeing them approve new devices every single day. I see the announcements. Maybe that's the – I'm just saying, I'm thinking of a watermark so that we can still get to the root of the issues, but we focus it on what will maximize traction at first, and then we can boil the ocean back. That at least is how I'm seeing it in my head.
Yeah, that's a pretty good approach if you go with the FDA devices, because there's going to be a framework that comes from that would potentially be applicable to non-FDA-approved devices. But to your point, it would at least allow some level of filtering to have the discussion.
Okay. Carolyn, Christina, is that an okay, like, watermark? So I think we bring this up, we elevate it and bundle it with the other items, but we try to focus on FDA-approved IoT devices.
Yeah, I think there's still a gray area on that. Like, I know back in my days of working for GetRails, we were like an app that got data and information from devices, such as a pulse ox or kind of a suite of devices. And some of those devices may have been FDA approved and some may not be, because that is like a big gray area right now. And some of that data is still very valuable, but a lot of these groups within the consumer app world have done a lot of work to vet which are more reliable and which aren't. And many of them are sourcing where the data is coming from, like specifically saying this is from a Fitbit for a provider to know, for example. So limiting to FDA approved, I think, kind of narrows the scope a little too much.
Okay. Is there a category? I mean, I think you can see the logic of what we're trying to think about here. If we don't say FDA approved only, is there another way for us to sort of slice this pie so that it's digestible in your mind? Maybe think about it a little bit.
Yeah, let me think about it.
Yeah, marinate
like
on
a
it.
Class right under, and I just can't remember what it is.
Okay, all right. So then, Michelle, we'll get back to you on that slice of it, but, you know, bundling it and then looking at IoT devices with some lens on it is what we're recommending. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. All right. Next item here, please scroll down.
I think we missed the synthetic data one.
Oh, did we? Did I skip over one? Sorry about that. Where? Oh, yeah, I did. I just totally.
It was yours, too, yeah.
I know. My goodness. Come on, man. All right. All right, privacy and security of synthetic data. Determine the unique privacy and security considerations driven by the emergence of synthetic data. Imagine being able to conduct research, train machine learning models, et cetera, without the constraints of HIPAA. All right. So let's again, talk about examples here. So one of the issues that we have encountered and running into is modeling, right? And so it's the next level of data analysis, data aggregation. And so typically when you look at, you know, real-world data sets, you're either going to get informed consent from the patient saying you can use this data for research purposes, or if it's for a true research project, it's IRB approved, you get a HIPAA waiver, which allows you to use the data appropriately to, you know, usually a COVID-19 data result, whatever else. But that takes time, right? And that draws a lot of resources and a lot of time and draws things out. And if you're looking at something like, I don't know, creating a vaccine for COVID-19, every day counts. Synthetic data allows you to mimic or perhaps take a real data set, completely jumble it up to fake names so that Aaron becomes, you know, Aaron or something. I don't know. You know, it's some fake information, but the information in there is relevant enough that you can model, right, and begin to start generating what could work, what could not, and then, you know, tease out those other issues. That's synthetic data, for lack of a better term, right? It's data that you're able then to really create those learning models that's self-learning, and then once you have actual data to plug in, you're able then to really extrapolate and hit the ground running. It just shortens your runway to goal. So the question then is, with synthetic data and even de-identified data that is sometimes considered synthetic, and even though we all know there's no such thing as true de-identified data anymore, what are those items that we should think about? Because all data should be treated respectfully and appropriately, and all data should be treated with careful gloves on, but there's not really a rules of the road when it comes to that. In my mind, though, I see this as something that ties also into the research domain and also with the earlier frameworks or for earlier topics around research that we need to how to exchange data with research easier. So to me, my suggestion up front would be to bundle this as one of the subtopics under the research item, but I'll leave it to you all to come up with your questions. What do you all think?
Aaron, help me understand a little bit further. So how does that differ from, just say, machine learning?
No, machine learning is done on synthetic data or on actual data, right? The more data you feed a model or an algorithm, the better that model becomes, right? And so what we've turned to are these giant data sets of, again, mirrored data, mimic data, whatever, but they're not actual patients to try to create those models. But then it's like, what do you do with this? You know, is it the Wild Wild West? Is it not? I mean, we treat it like HIPAA data here because we're just overly cautious about everything. But I'm not certain everybody does that. And there's a lot of big market now for synthetic data and getting bigger.
So you take a data set that is identifiable and you create essentially fake patients from that data, like randomize it. So what are you protecting HIPAA from? Because it's based on some actual data that maybe you can extrapolate back?
That's exactly what we talked about in HITECH, is that at some point, if you had enough specificity in the data set, you could pick out the unique patient or two, especially if something was something very, very unique. You could still try to get back at that, right, with enough reconstructive learning. And that's the whole problem with de-identified data, is that there's no such thing, as research has shown, as truly de-identified. And so the same logic applies for synthetic data. There's really no such thing as true synthetic data.
Yeah, thank you for your patience. That makes a lot of sense. It seems to me like it fits nicely with the previous HIPAA discussion, but what do y'all think, Carolyn? Christina?
I'm trying to think if there are devices that we don't typically think of as health devices where you would want data or connection, and that might bring additional issues or needs or baggage that would potentially implicate different agencies in terms of regulation or oversight. Like, you don't think about a thermostat being a healthcare device, but if you could monitor how the thermostat was set and you saw that it didn't change one morning when it was cold outside, that could be a signal that an elderly person had fallen at night and wasn't able to get up in the morning and turn up the thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be a signal, a trip that someone should call the house and do a well check. For example, if they didn't want motion detectors in the house. Some people are not comfortable with that, and I don't know that I would be myself. But, you know, the thermostat, that's something where your kid could, like, be monitoring it, you know, on the premise of it's part of the deal with paying the electric bill or, you know, sort of helping you manage the house and, you know, use that way. You don't think about the thermostat is not like the wearable or the tracker or something. I mean, it's not designed for healthcare, but you can, by looking at what it does, you can extrapolate healthcare uses for it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay. And that could feed into a synthetic data set. That's true. Okay. What else? Christina, what do you think?
I'm thinking. I mean, I probably am less versed in this topic. I like that what you laid out, Aaron, putting it in potentially with the research. I'm not sure.
Okay. So
the picture you painted sounds pretty. I mean, I think it's really important.
Yeah, it's very important, and it's getting even more important, right? And so that's it was another one of those. It's like the IoT item. It was more emerging, and now it's become pretty standard, particularly in the research community, right? In academia, I would use the term data hungry, but I think that's not doing it service. It's like voracious appetite for data, right? In the research community. So I see this every day. Maybe not everybody does, but I do. And so it's becoming more mainstream because obviously this is what's feeding all the machine learning and augmented intelligence algorithms that are out there is data, 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 right? So what are the protections of that, right? How do we ensure that there are rules of the road that are commonly understood? That's what this nets down to. So I'm hearing from this group then to promote this item into the other buckets. We're talking about the research bucket, correct? And then this is a subtopic of that. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's an important subtopic, too.
It's important. Yeah, it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. All right. Michelle, is that clear for you?
Yes, but the comment also talked about, like you already mentioned, training machine learning, and I think it would apply to when people are developing software and needing to test software. So I do think it goes beyond research based on what the original comment was. I mean, you can scope it however you want. I just don't want to lose that by accident.
That's a fair point. That is a fair point. It is beyond research, although I would consider R&D, even developing product, as research. But that's just my personal lens on it.
But you can make data. Like, you can just create fake data for R&D purposes, right? Like, you actually need real data.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you're creating an algorithm on OB patients between the ages of 20 and 30 that have type 1 diabetes that live within a certain zip code, aka one of my exact data requests that are sitting right in front of me right now that I'm reading here from one of my researchers, I need actual data on patients, right? And that's going to result to tens of thousands of patients, whatever, for the past decade or so. And then if I need more to finish this model, I create synthetic data, right? Or I find a synthetic data model of the similar types of patients. But you're going to need women who are pregnant between those age groups that have comorbidities like type 1 diabetes. You're going to have that. So that's the worry is, could you, from that bolus of patients, find that one or two unique patients, say, in this case, Travis County here in Austin, that have some other condition? And it's like, oh, man, now what? So I'm going to stand by, this is my personal opinion, I want the group's opinion on this, that this still could be promoted within the research domain, knowing, and we asterisk that it applies for more than that, but it starts with research and R&D. At least that's how I see it. Any objections to that?
I guess I'm not sure that it starts with...
Go ahead, Carolyn.
I'm not sure that it starts with R&D. I think there's any number of people who'd be more than happy to dive in if it helped them move down the road with a commercial purpose.
Okay, so how do we want to present this one then? What do we suggest?
Aaron, you could leave it as a standalone item for now and see what evolves as you think about more gaps and opportunities and see if it starts to fit somewhere else.
Okay. That's a great suggestion, too. I think we all agree it's an important topic. We just don't know where it belongs. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think so.
Okay. And again, this was emerging for some time, right? So it doesn't surprise me that we're all trying to scratch our heads. I think the market is doing the same thing. So, all right, then if we're going to take Michelle's suggestion into consideration then, let's hang on to this one and come back. I'm going to hear this yes. Okay, let's keep going here. All right. Next one is patient access to information. All right. The topic is patient-controlled data collection, access, and sharing. The gap is the safety of mobile health applications. And then the challenge is, of course, the safety and effectiveness concerns with consumer-facing mobile health applications. Boy, I could go on and on about this one. All right. I personally, this is my take, is that this feeds back to oversight and enforcement activities for mobile health applications, right? That app that you downloaded off the Android store that is spoofed and actually built in some foreign country that's taking your data and selling it, or, I don't know, TikTok or whatever, right? How do you make sure that there's granular consent and control for your data, what's happened with it, who's accessing it, et cetera, et cetera? I see this in line with the other components that we're trying to research around HIPAA and FTC jurisdiction, but I am curious you all's thoughts.
Aaron, I guess I read it a little differently. It sounds like you're taking more of a security focus. I saw it as a safety from a, how do patients know, is there a process? If I know if something has FDA approval in one regard or my organization has vetted it, then, you know, I can give that to a patient with some confidence. Is that, Michelle, is that where this one's coming from, or is it more of a security piece?
Yeah, I think, Brett, it's what you were saying.
Good. Okay, good. So then it's all about, what, making sure that people opt in, essentially?
Or they understand that, you know, if there's not going to be a government oversight and or approval process for health applications that you can pick up on, to your point, the Android store, App Store for an iPhone or something, that there's some kind of language that patients can understand that this has not been vetted by anyone outside of the company, and so they know what they're getting. Does that make sense?
It does. But correct me if I'm wrong, I thought a tremendous amount had been done on patient education and continues to be done on patient education around that awareness to their own, like, consumer health, right? There was that website that ONC put together a few years ago. There's been a lot of literature put out there. I mean, I'm not saying this is not important, but I know there's a lot of work underway on this stuff, right?
Yeah, you may be right. Specifically,
yeah,
mobile apps.
Yeah,
I don't think there's anything that I'm aware of that they're doing right now. But if there is, then somebody teach me and we can move on.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give a real example, right? So we rolled out Apple Health Kit here 2 years ago now, and it was a big consumer education push, patient push, that, hey, you know, you're empowered, you have your own access to your own data, and it's actually pretty easy to just download right into your Apple Health Kit. It ended up turning in my doctors into a bunch of texts because people don't know how to work their iPhones. And it didn't go over too well because of it. And so we had to do a lot of re-education and eventually helping our call center on how to do sort of like tier one support for folks. And then if they don't know, refer them back to the, you know, Apple for support. So there wasn't a way to level set, but this does tie back then to health equity and ties back to a lot of other topics we've already been talking about, right? How do you empower patients and consumers to use these tools?
Well, and to understand what they're using. Your example of the Apple Health Kit, there's nothing that I guess they can encourage you to exercise. I'm thinking more of a long download a diabetic app that starts telling me how to adjust my insulin with no data to support it. With, you know, and that's dangerous. I can't think of anything with my Apple Health Kit, because we did the same thing a couple of years ago. It's like, I don't think there's anything with that could be dangerous. It is more of the information exchange, whereas we're entering an era of actual digital therapeutics from these apps where they'll claim blank, and what kind of, and maybe it is a patient education piece, I'm not arguing that at all, but what kind of safety measures do we have in place so that patients understand just because it's on the Apple store, that doesn't mean it's legit.
Right.
They don't do that kind of vetting.
And by extension, how are we helping patients to understand the safety options available for the things that they're doing and make some of those decisions themselves, not just us guarding data, but them becoming proactive in managing?
You're exactly right, Carolyn, because that's the gap here. We're giving patients a bunch of information, and we're expecting them to be their own provider, and that's what we're trying to do for years and years. And so they can come to us, and we can do that, but that's not going to always happen. And so even though they can't all have an individual position every time they download a GAP comment or an app comment on that, that's what we're asking them to do. And so that, to me, that's the gap in safety, where if there isn't going to be government oversight on what's, you know, approved, or there's not an approval process, letting folks understand what they, you know, again, just because it's published doesn't mean that, or it's available, excuse me, that it's accurate or that can improve your health. It could be dangerous. So again, Aaron, maybe it does go back to patient education, what I'm saying.
Well, but I mean, I think that it's also about understanding what you're trying to do for yourself, because, you know, the diabetes management work is what's gotten a lot of the press, but there's another community that I think it's on hiatus right now that is looking at CPAP data and trying to do, you know, similar kinds of self-management things and self-understanding. And when you think about it, almost any kind of device that involves some data generated in some way is something where someone could want to access that and potentially use it in their own healthcare decision making or for self-observation, you know, or other things.
Okay. Christina, what do you think?
Yeah, when I was thinking through this, there's two buckets that I see. So when I was at Gitrell, we did the certification, and we had a privacy notice for patients. I forget what it was called. I was searching healthit.gov, but it told patients what, like, they could expect from the app, what the vendor had to fill it out. You had to say how the data was being used. But that was, like, required for certification or highly recommended. But there's another group of mobile applications that aren't, like, aligned with what Health IT is doing, but patients are using them. So it's almost like another gap is not just the it is the safety, but also the just vetting of certain applications and even more education, echoing what others have said about how patients can find apps that are going to actually work and have kind of a more of a gold star of approval.
So I'm going to use this very loosely, like almost like a Better Business Bureau seal of approval on an app for a certain criteria. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, you've got the challenges with safety and effectiveness concerns. And to me, that's being able to guide patients into using things that are safe and effective. And there are some apps that are educating patients as part of the process, and then there are some that aren't. As Brett said, how do you control what someone just downloads from their apps on their phone?
Okay. So what are we recommending then in terms of next steps then on this one? So I think we all agree this is important. We all want to make sure that there's informed consumer awareness, patient awareness, whatever. Do we want to do some more research on this and come back? Do we want to – what are we thinking?
In previous conversations, hadn't we had it as a proposed recommendation to kind of look at ONC's patient engagement playbook and just do a reevaluation on it. This one seems like that could be bundled into that work.
Okay. Do we feel that is a recommendation I recall us saying. Do we feel that's comprehensive enough, though, to meet the concerns you guys just brought up? Not saying it's not. I think ONC has done a phenomenal job. I've said that 1,000 times. I'm just asking the question just generally. Are there any other activities HITECH wants to bring up, or do we want to just refer to that?
Would this be part of a broader patient safety kind of initiative effort by HITECH?
It could be. It could very well be, Carolyn. I like that idea, actually.
It's sort of like an emerging area of patient safety, because so much of the work that's done in that area relates to technology that patients don't have any access to and can't be engaged in. But this is one where, you know, the implications and the opportunities might be broader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here thinking, like, what would Raj's team might be perhaps doing along these lines, or what might be the kind of thing that they would be interested in, even if they're not doing it.
I do like that dimension of patient safety, because, I mean, I've always said this, that, you know, at some point I want folks to stop talking about cybersecurity as some abstract thing that's actually about patient safety, right? At the end of the day, this is about do no harm. And so I love that idea, Carolyn, that we could recommend to the HITECH that we need a patient safety work group that talks about this and other things.
Yeah, patients taking control of patient safety, perhaps.
Yes.
Patients taking a more active role in patient safety.
Right, right, because it puts providers like Dr. Oliver in the firing line, right? They're going to be asking him, hey, man, should I download this thing or not? And he's like, hey, you know, you know, we're not arming our clinicians with the guidelines here. So
shared work.
Yeah. All right. So are we all in recommendation then to bring this as a potential recommendation back to the HITECH of a more broad? This could fit into a more broad patient safety work group where this is talked about in others and go into some specificity, which could include just using the ONC playbook and patient education. Again, it's been great work, but it could also include other activities. Is everybody in agreement with that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
All right. Okie dokie. I think, Michelle, if I'm not wrong, that's it, right? That was the whole list between this meeting and last meeting and the meeting before that.
That's correct. And the only question I had for you, if you want to do this, is Brett wasn't able to attend last month, so I'm wondering if there's anything we might want to bring up from things we discussed before they're marked in blue.
Let's see.
I'm sure you all had it more than adequately mapped out.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this. We even talked about it at the high. I would say, you know, I think before the last big HITECH meeting, that some of these, I would definitely, I would say, Brett, you know, you would want to weigh in, but you did weigh in on them. I mean, like during the HITECH, we talked about public health, the vaccine tracking, and clinical data exchange. I mean, we talked about those things. Unless there's items here that you want to go into. I mean, please do.
I've not seen it from this last time, so how about this? I'll take a look and then just share any comments to you guys by email. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Perfect. Okay. Michelle, what else do we have? Those are the two items, right?
That's everything.
Okay. Carolyn, do you feel good that we can go to public comment now, or are there other items, other business we should be talking about?
I'm good with that.
Okay. Lauren, if you're comfortable with that too?
That works for me. We're just pulling over the public comment slide, and then we'll ask the operator to please open the public line.
Thank you. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 to remove your comment from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we pull for comments. There are no comments at this time.
Okay. Thank you. Carolyn and Aaron, anything else before we close out?
What should we be thinking about in our heads as we go about our daily life? I think the plan for the next meeting on the 30th was to work on the crosswalk some more, and I'm wondering if that will be the full meeting or if there are other things we should be thinking about before then.
I'm actually going to defer to Michelle on this. She can probably better speak to the overall, unless we want to go visit the timeline slide again.
No, I think this is fine. There is a comment I can make that if, just like Brett offered to, if any of the rest of you have written comments you want to make, because I know you're kind of on the spot in the meeting sometimes and things occur to you later, this is like a perfect time to do that. I'll be working with our Audacious Inquiry team to make the updates you've made and use the research they've already done to kind of sort of fill in the blanks, and then we'll get at the next meeting more reactions to a more complete document, and we can show you a redline version at that time, so you can see where updates were made based on the original version. So if you have any more email, all of you have any more email comments for accepting those before the next meeting, preferably within the next week or so, so that we can integrate them, because the next meeting is only 2 weeks away.
Okay. Can do that. All right. So everybody needs to be studious on email and just thinking and marinating. That's a good suggestion. And I would also say, listen. I think right now it's time to listen to the community some more, especially as there are reports of a second wave of COVID that's starting to spin up in the Northeast corridor again. I know here in Austin, where we just got through our first wave, I think I can say that. Where things are calming down, but it's inevitable. So we'll hear of many other barriers and challenges to all these dimensions very soon. And so just keep your ears open. And if there's a topic that comes up that we haven't talked about, please let's bring it here, right? As I like, real world stories always tell the tale. So bring those stories.
And if we're going to tell stories, maybe we should start thinking about how we integrate stories into the annual report. If we do.
I like that. Actually, I like that idea a lot.
Then yes, I think we need to think about ways to incorporate them so that they're not super long, but, you know, 150-word pieces maybe that get sprinkled through in relevant places or something else. Michelle's probably groaning inside right now as I say that, so we should get your feedback as well.
I really like it. I think it would humanize the report because it's very academic at the moment. So I love it. And we can visually make that work pretty easily as well. Just one thing we might want to do is find a way to source them somehow, either by a person or a written source, just so there is clear who's saying them.
Yeah, we can look for stories in the popular media, and then
yes.
You're referring to a CNN story or something where it's pointing to, it's not establishing as, you know, God-proven fact.
Right. And what I like is, I know from the academic healthcare side, there's some great storytelling even recently in, like, the New England Journal of Medicine and some of these other more journal-type things that just sort of tell the tale of what's happening, specific to COVID and other conditions. So there may be some relevant scientific articles that we can point towards to tell the story as well. So there's no cause of concern of any bias depending on what data source we point to, right? So that's the only other thing, is that we got to worry about the lens the story is told through, because we want to keep this as fact-based as possible. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, if that is all, then, Carolyn, unless you object, I say we can give 10 minutes of time back to folks.
Let's do it.
All right. Everyone have a great one. Be safe, please.
Thank you all.
Thanks, everyone.
Everybody.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.